Before we get going, here's the bit where I remind you that nothing we discussed should be considered as investment advice. This conversation is for informational and hopefully entertainment purposes only. So while we hope you find it both informative and entertaining, please do your own research or speak to a financial advisor before putting a dime of your money into these crazy markets. And now, on with the show. Welcome, everybody, to another edition of the Grant Williams podcast. Something a little different for you today. Joining me in a moment is Brendan Ballou, who has written a book called Plunder, Private Equity's Plan to Pillage America. So we are going to talk about that book, talk about the private equity industry, talk about where and how it might be stopped, talk about the problems facing regulators. And I'm really, really looking forward to this conversation because it's something that anyone that reads Things That Make You Go Hmm will have seen that I've written at length about in previous editions. I think it's an incredibly important topic to discuss, and I'm curious to get the insight into it that Brendan has. Brendan is a federal prosecutor and has served as the special counsel for private equity in the Justice Department's antitrust division. He's a Columbia University and Stanford Law School grad, and I think this book, as I say, is an important work, and I'm extremely keen to have a chat with Brendan. So without any further ado, here is my conversation with Brendan Ballou. Brendan, welcome to the podcast. It's an absolute thrill to get a chance to talk to you.
Well, thank you so much for the time. I really appreciate it.
Well, this subject is something that anyone that reads my written work will understand is very close to my heart, the subject of private equity, which has become such an enormous feature of the global financial system and markets in particular. But before we get into that and the book, I'd love to get a little bit of your background to set that up for people who are about to eavesdrop on our little conversation here today.
Of course. So I am an attorney over at the Justice Department. And I should say off the bat that what we'll talk about today is my personal capacity. Speaking of my personal capacity, doesn't necessarily reflect the opinions of the federal government, of course. So I was working in the antitrust division. And, we review large mergers. When one company wants to buy another, antitrust and the Federal Trade Commission have a chance to look at it before it happens. And this was during the depths of quarantine, and I was looking at all these proposed acquisitions, and they were by firms that I had never heard of, you know, Blackstone, Carlyle, KKR. And so I started to look into them and started to, you know, learn about the world of private equity and just how astoundingly large and ambitious private equity firms were and how they were sort of expanding into every part of the economy. And that's what got me started on this project.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think for those of us in finance to whom those companies are household names, you know, we know those names so well. You know, it's interesting that they hadn't really come up so much on the Justice Department's radar up until that point. You know, one would have thought from the outside that they would have been just as familiar to you guys as they are to us.
Well, I don't want to cast dispersions on the Justice Department. But no, it's a good question because I think, you know, for folks in finance, you know, the names of Blackstone and KKR and Apollo and so forth are household names. For those outside, it's, you know, they're pretty mysterious. You know, it's pretty rare that you see a healthcare company be labeled as a Blackstone business or a nursing home chain labeled as a Carlyle company or what have you. And so I think for regulators, it's often easy to kind of see one big company in an industry buying another big company. When one healthcare company wants to buy another healthcare company, it's pretty obvious. When a private equity firm wants to buy one of these businesses, oftentimes they're businesses that we're not familiar with, and we're also not familiar with how the private equity business model works or what these firms are trying to accomplish.
So look, take us inside the process in that antitrust department. So I think that would be another good way of framing how it was slightly different with private equity. Because as you say, normally it's one big company taking another out. So take us inside that process of how the antitrust and the Department of Justice works in terms of analyzing these deals.
Sure. And I can talk in generalities here without
getting... Sure. Yeah. No, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. So normally what will happen when the antitrust division or the FTC or any regulator that deals with antitrust, state regulators also have a role to play here, will look at what are called HSR forms, Hart-Scott-Rodino forms, which is basically the application that a company files with the government that says, you know, we propose to buy this business and it has above a certain revenue threshold. And traditionally, the analysis will be looking at how will competition or concentration in a specific industry change. So we were talking about healthcare. You know, if one hospital chain proposes to buy another hospital chain, we'll look at, okay, what's the geographic market? What service are these hospitals providing? Will the number of competitors meaningfully decrease to such an extent that it could violate the antitrust laws? That's the traditional analysis here. And the challenge that I think a lot of regulators have with private equity firms is private equity firms are not one-to-one competitors with the businesses that they're buying for the most part. So, you know, the antitrust analysis isn't quite as obvious because, you know, at least on first blush, oftentimes it's not that there are going to be fewer competitors in a given market. And frankly, I think a lot of us that come from outside of finance don't really understand what a private equity firm is or what it's going to do to the business.
Yeah, that makes an awful lot of sense. So as you kind of dug down this rabbit hole, let's talk about your personal journey in understanding private equity, because that's the kind of crux of the book. It can be looked at as your personal journey, and you talk about what you found. So take us along that journey with you.
Sure. So I joke, you know, I didn't really understand what private equity was until, you know, probably halfway through this project. So perhaps to just set a baseline, maybe it'd be helpful for me to just say, at least, you know, my interpretation of the traditional leverage buyout model, and then how I sort of went down this journey. So traditionally, a private equity firm will use a little bit of its own money, you know, some investor money and a lot of borrowed money to buy a company. It will then try to execute financial and operational changes on the company with the aim of selling it for a profit a few years later. It's a very simple, straightforward idea. I got interested in it by looking at sort of what are the different industries where private equity is active. And I mean, the short answer is kind of they're active everywhere. You know, you look at 2021, private equity firms, I think, executed $1.2 trillion in acquisitions in the US alone. So it's a not insignificant part of the GDP. But I was really interested in seeing, okay, are there specific industries where private equity seems to be particularly enamored? And so there have been some headline industries that I think, you know, your listeners are probably familiar with, whether it's nursing homes, physician staffing companies, and healthcare more broadly, prison services, single family rental homes, and mobile homes, housing generally. And I think one of the interesting sort of discoveries of this project, and you know, there are a lot of nuances to this, is that in a lot of ways, many private equity firms target businesses, not ones that cater to the rich, but rather the ones that cater to the poor, which was sort of an interesting sort of discovery. And I think part of the reason is those are the industries where the firms are going to have a large ability to raise prices and potentially decrease quality care without consequence because the customers really don't have an alternative.
Yeah, I think that's been the journey of private equity. If you go back to its kind of foundational days, it was very much a different animal. It wasn't just a kind of conveyor belt of companies that we can take in, apply our model to, kick out the door. There were long-held acquisitions that where they really actually improved the business. And it wasn't necessarily with the view to selling it. It was a view to creating great businesses. So as you've kind of looked through the history of private equity, where do you think that may have changed?
That's a great question. I'm not sure there's like a pivot moment. And I'll say, you know, in my mind, I think that there are basically three challenges with the private equity business model. And you have a very financially literate audience, so they might disagree with some things that I'm saying. But I think the three basic problems are one that you just mentioned, which is a lot of private equity firms take a short-term perspective, invest for just a few years. Second is that they tend to extract a lot of fees and obviously layer up their companies with a lot of debt. And then the third, which is the part that sort of interests me as a lawyer, is they've been very successful at insulating themselves from liability for their portfolio company's actions. So to get to your sort of question, you know, when did this thing change? I think it's interesting in that I have seen, you know, there's a real spread in how different private equity firms approach this. Some firms take an extremely short-term perspective, and as a result, there are frequently problems with the businesses they buy. Other firms, some of the name brand firms, I think take a longer-term perspective, and as a result, I think the investments are less problematic and even be successful. But I think as long as there has been really easy money for private equity firms to get access to, you know, it's going to incentivize sort of shorter and shorter term thinking.
It's clear that the golden years of private equity have coincided with, you know, this 10 years of zero interest rate. I mean, if you give these companies free capital, we know what they're going to do with it. So again, you know, you mentioned there about how they kind of avoid any liability for their actions with the company. So let's take a little detour down that road, because obviously with you as a DOJ lawyer, that's your kind of bread and butter. And that's certainly a world that my listeners will be less familiar with. So take us down that journey as you kind of looked into what you saw and what that portends for the industry.
So I'm really interested in this part, and maybe I can kind of explain the challenge with a story. So Carlyle bought the nursing home HCR Manor Care in 2007. It was the second largest nursing home chain in the United States at the time. Carlyle then executed a lot of tactics that may be familiar to your audience, like a sale leaseback. They did a dividend recapitalization, ultimately sort of drained Manor Care of a lot of its assets, and a lot of staff were let go. Complaints by nursing home residents spiked and so forth. When one family sues because their mother actually died in a facility, you know, she needed help to go to the bathroom. There wasn't the staff to help her. She falls and hits her head. She ultimately dies. They sue Carlyle for wrongful death. But at that point, Carlyle actually gets the case dismissed by saying, oh, no, no, we are not technically the owners of HCR Manor Care. Rather, we merely advise a series of funds whose limited partners through a series of shell companies ultimately own the assets of Manor Care. And that was enough to get the case dismissed against them. And I think it illustrates a really interesting challenge that we've got with private equity, which is PE firms typically are able to effectively control the operations of their portfolio companies by choosing the management, choosing the board of directors, and so forth. But because we have doctrines around what's called piercing the corporate veil, typically they are not held responsible for the actions of their portfolio companies. So, you know, to the econ students in your audience, it's sort of a classic principal agent problem.
Walk us through how that story motivated you and changed the way you looked at private equity, because obviously that sent you off on a journey.
Yeah, well, I'm glad that you asked that question, because I think that story sort of affected me personally. Yeah. Seeing somebody that, you know, I think had a, you know, the claims were ultimately never adjudicated, so we can't say that things are definitively true or false, but it appears to be somebody that genuinely suffered and was not able to hold the business that caused that suffering responsible. I think what it made me realize is there's a lot of discussion around private equity that focuses on the leaders of private equity firms. You know, for their critics, they're evil geniuses. For their proponents, they're masters of the universe. For me as a lawyer, I think that's a little bit of a mistake, in that we probably shouldn't be focusing so much on the people that run these firms, and rather on the legal incentives that we've created for them. And if we've created a legal structure that essentially insulates businesses from liability, well, these sorts of consequences are going to be virtually inevitable. And so it got me thinking about what are the laws that have shaped private equity firms, and how does that change their incentives?
Well, I don't know what the numbers are, but I can imagine that the private equity lobby must be pretty sizable. one would imagine that they have the ear of just about everybody. So from a government insider's perspective, how do you stare down a lobby like that and sit there with any real thought that, okay, I can maybe make some change here? Because, you know, we've seen this with big tobacco, and we've seen it with big oil, and we all have a kind of sense from the outside of just how powerful lobbyists can be. But obviously, you're the guys that are really facing the other side of that and standing there like David in front of Goliath. So how do you frame that in your mind?
Well, I think the power of the private equity industry is hard to overstate. PE firms and investment firms have given something like $900 million to federal candidates in the U.S. since 1990. Right. They have brought into their fold and hired former speakers of the House, former secretaries of state, treasury, defense, a vice president, any number of senators. So they have an extremely deep bench of people that are willing to advocate on their behalf. I think, you know, one of the things that really encourages me is I've seen a lot of really effective advocacy on specific industries where private equity has been active. I think it's challenging to sort of talk about private equity in the abstract, because for people outside of your listenership, I think it sounds very boring, you know, to be honest.
No, absolutely right.
Yeah. But when you talk about specific industries, I think it becomes very real to people. When you talk about, you know, the estimated 20,000 premature deaths that have happened in nursing homes, when you talk about exorbitant rates that people have had to pay for prison phone calls, which is a private equity dominated industry. When you talk about the increased rents that mobile home residents have had to pay, I think that is I think that resonates with people. And more than just resonating, I think it's had an effect. The really encouraging story that I keep thinking about is there's been a broad movement to stop price gouging by prison phone companies, which again are owned by private equity firms. And there have been a handful of activist organizations, Worth Rises, along with others, that have effectively pushed state and local legislation to cap costs for prisoners and actually just got federal legislation passed. So I think when people who are passionate about these issues focus on a specific industry and also have specific legislation or specific regulations that they want to move, there's actually a real evidence that it can work.
I guess from our side of the fence, we look at private equity and we look at the results of those private equity companies and we look at how those private equity companies are doing. And we read the headlines, we read the deals we're doing. And from our side of the fence, it's all, you know, KKR's going into the prison phone services. Well, that may not be the case, but we look at it like that. And then we lose track of those individual stories, those individual businesses, because it's all rolled up into the profits of the headline private equity firm. You know, so it's interesting to think about these different companies and different industries from the grassroots up, as opposed to the way we look at it, which is why I'm so interested as to how you've gone about doing this, because you are coming in to the prison phone call industry and to the nursing home industry and taking a look at there, which is a view we don't get to see. So talk about some of these other businesses. You know, you talked about prison firms, nursing home chains, mobile home parks is another one that I know that there's a lot of private equity involvement in. Walk us through some of those industries and how private equity has affected them.
Yeah. So one of the first stories that got me interested in was single family rentals. And, you know, you've talked before about the financial crisis of 08. Private equity's involvement really, it begins with that crisis. So, you know, there are mass foreclosures across the country in the U.S. At that point, I mean, people may disagree, but I think one of the ways that the government could have kept more people in their homes would have been to temporarily reduce or freeze payments on the principal of mortgages. You know, would have made it rational for people to stay in their homes. It would have reduced the ripple effect in whole neighborhoods and so forth. The federal regulators for that, Fannie and Freddie, along with the FHFA, adamantly refused to consider principal reduction. But what they did instead was started selling off tracts of foreclosed homes. So rather than foreclosed homes individually, tracts that only investors could buy, started selling off those tracts to private equity firms, Colony Capital and others, Blackstone and so forth. And rather than ultimately reselling those homes to individuals, the private equity firms, through their portfolio companies, converted them into single family rentals. And that has had a real sea change effect in a whole lot of neighborhoods. When you look at specific neighborhoods in Atlanta or Las Vegas or, you know, other cities that were really affected by the Great Recession, you hear reporting saying, look, it's the same people living in the neighborhood, but they don't own their home anymore. They're renters. And that really kind of changes the nature of wealth in America. I don't know if this statistic has been verified, but, you know, overall home ownership has declined significantly since 2008. I've heard reports that home ownership among African-American families is back down to the level that it was during the civil rights movement. So, you know, there's been a real revolution in home ownership in America, and a lot of leading private equity firms helped to start that.
So, you know, again, it's so interesting to have these two different vectors to look at the same problem. Because I think, say, from the financial market perspective, we look at all this stuff going on. We can see all this going on. We can see exactly what you're talking about. We can see Blackstone buying up these, you know, hundreds of thousands of homes. And we can see that being a pattern across different private equity firms, different investment partnerships. We see all that. And, you know, I think from our perspective is nobody going to do anything about this? We observe it, but we're not in a position to do anything about it. For the investor, you're left with this weird situation where you can choose to be outraged about this and say this is going to lead to complete disaster, but your job is to try and make money out of it, right? And that's your job. And so you find a lot of people kind of holding their nose and investing in this stuff, but at the same time, they're in a self hoping, you know, I wish something would be done about this. So give us the perspective from the other side of that fence, where you as a government employee in the Department of Justice look at this situation How do you think about it, and how do you start to go about first understanding it, and secondly, trying to find a way to come up with a better way of doing things?
It's a good question, because, and it kind of goes back to this idea that I think a lot of activists have focused on the people running private equity firms or the people giving them money and have tried to personalize this argument. As long as people want to or need to make money, you know, they're going to do things like the private equity business model. And so I think it's a mistake for people that are concerned about private equity to sort of personalize this debate. Instead, I think it's really important to think about what are the legal incentives that push private equity firms to think short term, to insulate themselves from liability and so forth. And here, I think the really important point is, traditionally, activists and regulators have really looked to Congress for action. You know, it's only Congress can pass federal legislation. That's true. But Congress, I think, has really struggled to act on a lot of these issues historically. You know, when you look at the carried interest loophole, which means that I pay probably a higher tax rate than Stephen Schwarzman does or whatever, you know, that's been an issue for 16 years now. And thus far, there hasn't been significant movement on it. So there is a role for Congress to play, but I'd also say that there's an important role for regulators to play, whether you're talking about the Securities and Exchange Commission, Treasury, Fed, and so forth. Also, states and localities. One of the things that I'd be really interested in seeing is states looking at legislation to say, okay, if a business is headquartered in our jurisdiction, you can't perform an excessive dividend recapitalization. Or if you do, and ultimately the business goes bankrupt, the laid off employees can recover part of the lost earnings from the private equity firm that caused it. Localities can be doing the same thing. Also, private litigants and activists can be active here. You know, there's a whole range of, you know, sort of litigation opportunities that individuals can pursue. All they need is to sort of be educated on what's going on with private equity firms. So what I'd say is, you know, I'm sympathetic to the person who says, look, I'm an investor and I need to make money. And ultimately, this is the best way to make money. I don't make the rules. I would also say we need to think creatively about where those rules come from and look at the levers of sort of government to see how can we change incentives so that people who want to invest ethically can do so.
Yeah. And I think that's the crux of the problem here is that it feels as though now more than ever, this arms race between regulators and government and investors and private equity firms, the difference between the means available to the latter versus the former is just enormous at this point. And I think we kind of sit there and watch as there's a debate in the media about capitalism and there's a debate in the media about democracy. And ultimately, to me, that all comes down to policymaking, you know, because as you said, you know, those are the rules and we have to play the game by the rules. And so, you know, I have a degree of sympathy with people that look at the tax code and look at all the rules that are put in place and say, okay, how do we best utilize this code? Are there any loopholes? That's what they're there for, too. That's what their legal advisors, their financial advisors, their accountants, their tax attorneys, they're all there to give them the best way to use the law and stay on the right side of it. So to me, it always feels as though the change here has to come on the regulation side. It has to come on legislation side. And you kind of sit there hoping that's going to happen, but realizing, and as we watch the SEC try to work their way through the crypto space and try to come up with something meaningful there, you just realize it's such a difficult thing to do. And from my side of that, it feels almost hopeless. It feels like I should just abandon all hope that the government are going to get ahead of this, because it would mean swinging regulation that we know the lobbyists are going to come out in full force against and either tie up for years or knock back completely.
So two things. One is I think that there, you know, you shouldn't be Pollyanna-ish and overly optimistic about things, but there are real areas where activists and regulators have been able to constrain business models to make them more pro-social. You know, I just mentioned the prison phone call ones. That's a real success story. There's been really interesting rulemaking. We were talking about nursing homes earlier. Thanks to real work by activists and regulators, there's now rulemaking going on to establish minimum staffing criteria so that there's, you know, a minimum number of nurses for each resident. Similar efforts are going on across sort of the board on all the different areas where private equity is active. And I think people are sort of pessimistic right now, but I will say there really is historical analogies for success. In a lot of ways, private equity firms are legally very similar to the trusts of the 19th century, you know, when you talk about the oil trust and the steel trust and so forth. And, you know, those existed for a generation, but ultimately through the populist and progressive movements, there was a wave of positive regulation that ultimately constrained the trust, whether it was the creation of the Federal Trade Commission, the creation of our modern antitrust laws, progressive income tax, the first labor regulations, and so forth. So, you know, I sort of joke, it's not that change is impossible. Maybe it's just we haven't lived long enough yet, you know, because we do have historical examples where ultimately you really can have big change that makes a fundamentally fairer economy. And what happened in the 1910s and 20s and that sort of legal revolution lasted until the 1970s. So it can be really structural, long-lasting change.
But we had, I think that regulation, you know, you had a lot of that stuff coming in the wake of the 1907 crash. And we obviously had many more crashes back then. We had a lot more volatility. We got a lot more regulation in the 30s after the Great Depression. And it feels as though you need some kind of event to be able to shove this kind of regulation through. You know, and that was, I think, for many, the big disappointment post 08. We saw legislation put in place, Dodd-Frank, Volcker, all these kind of things that were put in place after the global financial crisis. But, you know, nobody went to jail. There was no example made of anybody. And here we are again, in the same situation, only worse this time because of a lot of things we've talked about. And it just feels as though in order to make meaningful change in areas like this, you need the private equity firms, you need the big banks to be in a position of great weakness in order to be able to kind of push stuff through against them. So am I wrong in thinking that way? And if so, how do you go about keeping the pressure on in times of strength so that you're ready in times of weakness to actually say, okay, we've got the upper hand now, let's push forward with this.
I love that you mentioned the 1907 crash because that leads to the Pujo Committee, which ultimately leads to the modern antitrust laws. You know, 1930s, you have the Pecora Commission, which leads to the creation of the SEC and so forth. So there's definitely historical precedent for sort of crisis breeds positive regulations for the long term. I think one of the challenges that we've got, if I can tell a little bit of a story here.
Please, floor's yours.
Is one of private equity's big successes, I think, has been in making their issues seem incredibly boring, you know, and
so
in the weeds. One of the stories that I'm really obsessed with is Sun Capital bought the diner chain Friendly's in 2007, executed many of the tactics that we were talking about dividend recapitalizations and sale leasebacks. Ultimately, they pushed the company into bankruptcy. But Sun Capital wasn't just the largest equity owner in Friendly's, it was also the largest lender, which is really interesting. And maybe some of your listeners are familiar with this tactic, but by being the largest creditor, they were able to credit bid what they owed and then essentially lever that up so that the firm was sold from Sun Capital to Sun Capital. And there were basically two tactics in bankruptcy that were used. One I just mentioned, which is credit bidding. The other is something called a 363 sale, which is sort of expedites the bankruptcy process in favor of the debtor. By using those tactics, Sun Capital was able to keep control of Friendly's, but slough off the pension obligations of the company onto the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation. Now, I think that there's a lot of reform that can be done just by correctly interpreting the laws by the bankruptcy judges on 363 sales and credit bidding. The challenge that we've got is it sounds like an incredibly boring topic. And for a judge that, you know, is just reading the briefs of Sun Capital and Friendly's, you know, they're presumably going to, you know, think that that's a reasonable interpretation of the law. So I think one of the challenges that we've got is helping to educate the public about some of these obscure issues. And I actually do think people care about obscure issues if they understand their importance. I think your podcast and others kind of helps people understand these things. And then that can lead to public pressure on the decision makers to help them interpret the law and understand the consequences of their actions. So to give a long answer to your short question, I think that, you know, crisis is an opportunity for reform, but I also think that part of the challenge is just educating people on these specific issues so that they can pressure, you know, decision makers here.
I think that's a great point. And for me, the longer the answers are, the better. I'll listen to the answers all day. But yeah, the point you make there, I think, is such an important one in that the whole industry is incredibly arcane and deliberately so. And it's kept opaque and it's very confusing and it feels very boring. And so, you know, trying to get the public animated about this is very, very difficult because it requires a dedication to understand it that goes above and beyond trying to understand normal things in the news. I mean, you can get a rudimentary understanding of the Ukraine war and take a position on it pretty easily if you read a few headline pieces. Now, that the position you take will have been shaped by whichever publications you read, but at least you'll feel like you have some sense of what's going on. If you wanted to try and familiarize yourself with how private equity works, it's almost an impossible task if you are a layman who doesn't really have the bit between his teeth to understand this. And so with the speed of the news cycle and the kind of cornucopia of things that we all have to be worried about, and we all have to kind of know about and understand about, how do you possibly bring private equity into the place where it should be? Because I think you're right. If you walk out on the street right now and 1,000 people walk past you, 900 of them are affected in some way indirectly by some private equity transaction that has changed something that is involved in their life. How do you move that forward into the public consciousness?
Yeah, no, it's a really important question. One thing that I say to people that are trying to be active on this issue, you know, activists, is, get a Wall Street Journal subscription. You know, there's a sort of funny disconnect between people that are really passionate about this issue and, you know, the listeners of your audience who probably read Bloomberg and FT and everything else. You know, it's worth the money to get educated on these sorts of things. But in terms of education in the other direction, one of the things that I sort of stumbled upon is, you know, it really helps to just talk about how private equity affects the average listener or reader's life, you know, every day. One of the things that seems to get people the most worked up is private equity access to 401k funds, which is this sort of journey that's going on now. Your listeners may be familiar with this, but just to explain it briefly, historically, private equity firms have gotten their money to invest from, you know, primarily pension funds and sovereign wealth funds. They have, you know, essentially tapped out on that. You know, they've been enormously successful and are now looking to get access to 401k funds. Historically, they haven't been able to do that for concerns about getting sued under ERISA, the retirement statute. But thanks to essentially a decade of lobbying, in 2020, the Department of Labor, along with the SEC, issued a letter that essentially insulated 401k fund managers from liability if they decided to invest in PE funds. That letter has since been partially walked back, but not entirely. And so what it means is we're now in a position where private equity firms are sort of in a space race to try to get access to individuals' 401k funds. And that can have potentially bad consequences for the companies they buy, but also could have potentially bad consequences for, you know, the ordinary investor with a 401k account. Telling people that story that their own money may soon be going to private equity investments and the risks that that might entail for them and for the economy, I think has gotten the people that I talk to, you know, really animated. So I think explaining how PE affects people's ordinary lives can really get people activated. If I can give one more example on this, the other sort of story that sort of gets people animated is private equity expansion into the insurance business, which you may be following. So probably the leader here is Apollo, which invested in, helped create, and ultimately now owns Athene, which is a life insurance and annuity company. There has been a real arms race for private equity firms to buy insurance companies because insurers, you know, insurance policy holders give them money every month, and that money can be used for leverage buyouts or other investments. The challenge that we've got, according to public reporting, is that many private equity firms are shifting the policies over to shell companies in Bermuda, which have lower capital requirements, which obviously allows them to have more money with which to invest in their various projects. But obviously that also increases the chance that the insurance company will ultimately fail. And if it does, that policy will be taken over by a state guarantee organization, not by the private equity firm, and it may or may not be able to pay out the full benefits. So that's a story that's going on. And when you talk to people about it, they get really agitated because a lot of them have life insurance policies or annuity policies. But to go back to sort of our recurring theme here, private equity firms have made this issue seem very obscure and very technical and have made it hard for people to understand what the consequences might be to their own lives. It's sort of how subprime lenders seemed, you know, oh so opaque and complicated 20 years ago, or, you know, conglomerates did in the 60s, or, you know, SNLs did in the 1980s.
Yeah, so true. I mean, it's funny, you know, the very fact that someone would allow private equity to have access to 401ks. When I first read about that a while ago, it just blew my mind. But if you think about the overall environment, you know, we've been in this era of free money, we've been focused on gains. Everyone's been focused on the gains they could make. And, you know, this FOMO idea, which is very real in financial markets, this idea of the fear of missing out, has led people to say, well, look at what you could, look what returns could be if you allowed these people into private equity. And it feels as though in the last couple of years, there's been a very definite shift in attitude where people are starting to think more about the risks associated. There seems to be a lot more risk around us every day, particularly in financial markets. And I wonder if governments, like investors, are also hostage to kind of greed and fear, in that in times of low fear and high greed in society, legislators tend to have that same thing and look about the potential for gains and returns and a reduction of restraints on things. And if we're moving back into a framework where risk is more important, fear takes the upper hand, does that change the way policy is made in your experience?
I'm not a bank regulator, so I can't speak to that experience,
sure.
But I think it's sort of a normal human reaction that it's hard to tap the brakes on something when, you know, it's headed in exactly the direction that you want. It's only when things start to seem like they're going bad that you feel impelled to step in. What are the challenges? Well, I think there are really two challenges at a human level for regulators. One is the fact that we've already talked about, which is these are often very obscure, complicated issues. And it's hard to sort of dig into them when there's not good research on the other side saying, here's why this might be a risky business development. The other thing, I think about this less in terms of private equity specifically, but, you know, appear in court sometimes and I see lawyers from big white shoe law firms and they dress better than I do. They certainly make more money than I do. And I think about how hard it is for a judge to go against somebody that, you know, might literally make five times the money that they do.
Yeah.
And tell them, Your Honor, if you do this thing, you know, it's going to blow up a company. Jobs are going to be lost. You know, savings are going to be destroyed and so forth. And I think that there's just a psychological challenge for anybody to stand up and look critically when somebody that's so well-dressed, so well-compensated, so well-educated tells you that if you decide in the other direction, catastrophe will follow. So I don't think that, you know, we're not going to fundamentally change human nature anytime soon. But the solution here is to build the infrastructure for educating ordinary people and ordinary decision makers on private equity. And so part of that, you know, for the activists is getting a Wall Street Journal subscription. Part of that also is for activists to do a good job of communicating these policies to people. And I'll shout out, you know, Americans for Financial Reform, the Private Equity Stakeholder Project, American Economic Liberties Project have all been doing really important work on that. There just needs to be more of it.
Isn't this the job of regulators and government, is to look past the obvious vested interest? You know, because on the other hand, the guy in the fancy suit and the great shoes with the expensive briefcase, it's pretty clear where his motivations lie, right? It's to earn more money. And he's arguing a case that will absolutely do that. You know, wherever I look across the regulatory spectrum or the legislative spectrum, I see this inability to remove oneself and take a look at any situation, whatever it may be, with cold, clear eyes and say, okay, what's really going on here? And so the amount of pressure that's put on the Department of Justice, for example, when a big merger is going through, or the Federal Trade Commission or any of these entities, is enormous. And it is, as you say, that pressure comes from people driving fancy cars, wearing great suits, and who stand in the courtroom glowing. Is that a battle that you can reasonably expect to have any chance of winning?
Potentially, because it's been won before. One of the examples that I think about is surprise medical billing. So just to set a baseline here, in the United States, what will often happen is you'll go to the ER, even if it's an ER that you believe that's in network, but then receive a bill as if you had not been in network. And they do that by essentially bringing in doctors from a different hospital to work a shift there and essentially surprise you, hence the name surprise medical billing. This is a huge problem. You know, somebody can go in for a heart attack and leave with $250,000 medical bill. I think one in five Americans are affected by medical bills right now. It's a huge problem. private equity firms have strongly opposed a legislation on surprise medical billing, partly because Blackstone and KKR own the leading staffing companies. And for many years, they were successful at stopping any legislation on surprise medical billing. And there was a real unfortunate, almost transactional sort of nature to the elected officials that supported it. You know, one of them blew up a compromised position on surprise medical billing and then received, I think, $31,000 from a private equity firm. So it's pretty dispiriting stuff. That said, after two sessions in Congress, a bill actually passed to stop surprise medical billing. Now, it is far from perfect. It ultimately doesn't solve the problem. It pushes the fight to insurers. It exempts ground ambulances and so forth. But it's an example where, despite enormous vested interests by companies and by private equity firms, by lobbying, spending millions of dollars, by direct contributions to many, many elected officials, still legislation passed. And it's legislation that will change Americans' lives. So again, I don't want to be overly optimistic here, and I don't want to be Pollyanna-ish here, but there are examples where through concerted effort on a specific issue, you can actually have a change.
In your course of investigating all this into the book, you know, I think you found that on the government side, there was support for the private equity side of the table. So talk a little bit about what you found when you looked at the government side of this kind of two-way dynamic.
Yeah. So, you know, to go back to the earlier statistics, it's something like $900 million in contributions and an extremely deep bench of elected officials that former elected officials and appointed officials that have gone to private equity. I think even more than just the secretaries of state and treasury that have gone to PE, it's the lower level staff that really matter. You know, when it's the chief of staff or the legislative director that goes, it means that, you know, when a private equity firm needs to lobby somebody, they're going to be lobbying with a friendly face. That has really shown off. I think probably the leading example is the carried interest loophole. Mm-hmm. As I may have mentioned, you know, this has been on the national agenda since, I think, 2007. Then Senator Obama campaigned against it. President Obama tried to stop it. President Trump, interestingly enough, also opposed the carried interest loophole and repeatedly tried to close it. And President Biden, in his first budget, tried to do so as well. All three of them have failed. And the really interesting one is most recently, in President Biden's effort, the effort was eventually dropped from the budget, re-added to what was called Build Back Better, then the Inflation Reduction Act, and then killed. And in fact, on the final days of passage of the Inflation Reduction Act, you know, there's a sort of votorama of various amendments to try to add programs to the IRA. These were programs to add, you know, dental and medical benefits to Medicare, proposals to expand the child tax credit and free, you know, reduced price lunches for children. All of those programs failed. But the one program that did succeed was a clarification on the tax code that confirmed that private equity firms would be less likely to have to pay a new corporate minimum tax. And that's a pretty extraordinary story about what certain elected officials' priorities were in this monumental legislation.
Look, I think for the kind of outsider looking in, if you can have presidents as opposed in platform as Trump, Obama, Biden, all failing to kill that particular piece of legislation, A, it makes you realize just how strong the lobby is. And with the money at stake here, it's no big surprise. But it also, again, makes you think that it's just too big a difference in firepower between the people behind the scenes lobbying to make sure this doesn't happen and those trying gamefully to kind of get it pushed through.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, again, this is sort of the recurring theme of what we've been talking about, which I think is really important, which is, you know, is progress possible on this issue? And on the one hand, private equity firms, like many other very successful businesses, have a large army of lobbyists. This is broader than PE, but I think that there are more lobbyists working on tax issues than members of Congress by, like, I think it's like 5x. I think there's like 7,000 lobbyists working on tax issues. I could be wrong about that number now. There's a very deep bench of people that are willing to advocate on these issues. I think one of the advantages that we've got is, I'll just say this speaking personally, I think most people in government want to do the right thing. And, you know, for every sort of headline story about somebody leaving to go work for a gigantic company or, you know, a private equity firm or something like that, I can tell you a dozen stories about people that spent their careers in government and, you know, are incredibly dedicated to the mission of trying to serve the American people in a way that I think is really inspiring. And they want to do the right thing, but they need the information and the education to do so. So I think one of the challenges that we've got, hopefully this book is a small contribution, hopefully your podcast and others are contributions here too, is to help people understand the private equity business model so that, you know, activists can come to government agencies and help to explain, here are the bad consequences we're worried about. Here's what you need to do.
So in terms of what needs to be done, what can be done? What are the steps that can be taken to try and rein in the control that private equity has over the entire economy now, really?
Yeah. So I think that, you know, private equity firms don't need to end. They just need to be made less interesting in a sense, you know, to go back to our original problems. What's the problem with the private equity business model? Investment for the short term, loading companies up with debt and extracting onerous fees, and insulation from liability. If you solve those basic problems, private equity firms can be made incredibly valuable, because as long as companies need to hire workers and build new factories, there is a role for capital to play, you know? So how do we do that? Obviously, legislation in Congress could help address this, but there's also a lot that can be done by federal regulators on specific issues. You know, I already mentioned HHS is working on nursing home staffing. You know, the SEC can work on necessary disclosures and making sure that PE firms actually have a fiduciary responsibility to their investors. Treasury and the Federal Reserve can designate certain PE firms as systemically important. So there's action that can happen at the federal level, but then there's a lot that can happen at the state and local level. I sort of gestured to this earlier, the idea that states can say, okay, if a company is headquartered in our jurisdiction, there are certain abusive tactics that you can't exercise. Or if you do exercise and there are bad consequences, you'll ultimately be held liable. So if you perform a sale leaseback and the company goes bankrupt in the next 2 years, you know, employees can recover some of the money. So there are ways that private equity firms can be made responsible for their actions and to start thinking long term. I also just think that there's a role for activists and litigants to play here, whether it's looking at firms buying up physician staffing companies that may be violating state corporate practice of medicine laws, or, you know, workers at companies finding that they were not given proper notice when there were layoffs. The book gives a lot of examples, frankly, maybe too many examples of sort of the things that ordinary folks can be doing to have an effect here. But I think the first step is just people getting educated on the issue. And I wouldn't say necessarily getting angry, but getting inspired to sort of take action here.
I think we may see in the not too distant future, with rates rising the way they are, we may see some pretty spectacular blowups in the private equity space, which might actually kind of bring a few metaphorical pitchforks and torches out into the streets. Because as you say, you know, the private equity tentacles run right the way through the economy now, and it's very difficult to see an industry that won't be affected if private equity has its day of reckoning, which one would imagine, not necessarily for the longer established, more savvy firms, but the newer ones with the more short-term attitude, I would imagine, who haven't had any experience of cost of capital being anywhere near where it is today, that could be something that happens naturally, one would imagine.
You know, the interesting challenge that we've got is, you know, when a quote unquote private equity firm goes under, you know, the first person to go under isn't the firm, it's the business that they bought. And I think it's going to be challenging for reporters and for ordinary people to understand the connection there that, yeah, you know, if a random veterinary practice or, you know, a random retailer goes under, helping people understand that in part, the reason that it might've gone under is, you know, it was required to take on, you know, lever up to, you know, pay for the private equity acquisition, or, you know, assets were sold so that the firm could have a transaction fee. So it's going to be, in some ways, an even harder sort of reporting and education project than existed during the Great Recession, which obviously was an incredibly complicated story. Here, I think understanding responsibility is going to be so diffuse that it's going to be interesting if reporters are going to be able to tell that story clearly.
Fantastic. Absolutely fascinating. I have to ask you one more question, and that is, how does the process work for being an active member of the Department of Justice and being able to write a book like this? I'm fascinated to find out how that's possible.
It's so funny. When I talk with anybody that has any interaction with government, that is the first question. Yeah. And they are
I thought I'd save it to last.
yeah. So I have to say my bosses were just incredibly kind in letting me do this. So, you know, I wrote up the book proposal during quarantine and we got a publisher and they gave me 6 months off to write it. Obviously, I have to caveat every time that I'm speaking in my personal capacity, but within those strictures, they've been incredibly kind. And I hope that it's a bit of a roadmap for other government employees. I think working for the federal government is one of the great secrets that I and others have discovered. It's great, meaningful work. And if this encourages other people to join the government and allows them to sort of pursue their own passions in addition to working, I think it would be really exciting.
I think it's so true. I think the more people in positions of government like you who are able to shine a light into that world for us on the outside, I think the better it will be, because I think you can make some real change if you do that, if the public can start to understand better how the government works and the kind of constraints they operate under, and frankly the foes they're fighting, because they are, as I said, far more powerful, far more rich, far wealthier, and in a much stronger position to do things that the government just can't do. So yeah, I commend you for writing the book. I hope a lot of people listening to this go out and buy a copy. So just before we finish, just let people know more about where they can buy the book. I mean, I presume it's fairly standard, but also any other websites they can visit to find out more about activist causes, etc.
Sure. So the book is called Plunder, Private Equity's Plan to Pillage America. It's released May 2nd. You can buy it anywhere books are sold, in person or online. If you're looking to learn more about private equity, I'd recommend a couple organizations: Americans for Financial Reform, the Private Equity Stakeholder Project, American Economic Liberties Project, and Worth Rises. I think that they're all great organizations, and I hope folks learn more about them.
Fantastic. Brendan, I wish you all the very best with the book, and I thank you sincerely for giving up an hour of your day to come and chat with me about it.
I'm really grateful. Thank you for the time.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. It's such a fascinating subject. You know, I despair at how outgunned and outmanned the government are in this particular arena. But, you know, hopefully with more people like Brendan understanding this and getting the word out to try and stir any kind of opposition to private equity's tentacles spreading further into the American economy, I think that would be a good thing, without any question. So once again, the book is Plunder, Private Equity's Plan to Pillage America. As Brendan said, you can find it in any bookstop, Amazon, etc., Barnes & Noble, if they're still going. I don't know. Who knows? Maybe they still are. But my thanks to Brendan for taking the time to talk to me about what is a fascinating subject. That's it for me for another podcast. My thanks to you for listening. I'll be back again with another conversation soon. Nothing we discussed should be considered as investment advice. This conversation is for informational and hopefully entertainment purposes only. So, while we hope you find it both informative and entertaining, please do your own research or speak to a financial advisor before putting a dime of your money into these crazy markets.